This morning I want to talk about privilege and encourage us all to a self-examination of our own privilege. Now, when I was preparing this, and people asked me, what are you going to talk about? I told them just that. And every one of them said, what do you mean? And they start asking me questions. I promise I'll get there. But in order to get there, I need to tell a story first. On July 31st, 1976, I was one of 35 women with Campus Crusade for Christ, now known as CRU, who were in the Big Thompson, Colorado flood. And that night there were three storm fronts that converged over Estes Park and dropped about 10 to 12 inches of rain that went down that narrow canyon walls. And it made about a 10 to 12 foot wall of water coming down the narrows. And when it hit where we were, it was just at the end of the narrows, and we were at the Sylvandale Ranch. And I'll go into the story in a minute, but seven of my friends died that night. And I want to come back and tell you what happened. The day, and 150 people died that night in the Big Thompson flood. I was 26 years old, and I knew everything, as you do at that age. Any 26-year-olds, I'm sorry if you're here and you're offended by that. But it was a beautiful day. There was no warning that there was going to be a flood. There had been no predictions of it at all. And it was, we went horseback riding, we went swimming, we sat around, we talked, we ate, we enjoyed, we laughed. And that night at about 9:30, we were getting together in the basement of the lodge we were staying in just to share and to pray and to prepare for the 3,000 staff that were coming in the next day. It was about 9:30 when all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, we hear a bullhorn. A flood is coming. A flood is coming. It's a flash flood. Get out. Evacuate immediately. Get to higher ground. And they just kept repeating that over and over again. And we all looked at each other. We had no clue what was going on. Finally, someone said, well, I looked earlier, and it looked like there was a huge amount of discord in the river. We better do what they say. And that they kept repeating it. We found out later that that guy wasn't going to come down to where we were because they were afraid it was too late. And yet he said, there's too many women down there. They won't know what to do. So he drove his car down and with his bullhorn warned us. We ran up the one staircase. We didn't take anything. We went and piled into the eight cars that were out front. And we didn't know where higher ground was. And so two of the cars went on one side of the river and went up to a cabin way up high, we found out later. Two went back on the property and went up and ended up in that same cabin. And the four cars, the one I was in the last one, followed the police car across the bridge where the flood was in the Big Thompson River. And just as we got across, we turned around and the bridge was washed away. And the room we had been in, they found out, had trees and mud and water up to the ceiling. So had we not been warned, I think all 35 of us would have undoubtedly died that night. As we get up to the side of the mountain, they kept yelling at us. And what I heard, get out of your cars and climb. The flash flood is coming. Get out and climb. So my friends and I got out and climbed. Two of the cars heard different instructions. They heard, get in your cars and drive east to Loveland. And what we didn't know until the next morning, they drove east to Loveland and were caught in the flood. The flood pulled both the cars into the middle of the river. Two of my friends lived that night, Melanie Alquist and Marilyn Rydberg. They got out of the cars miraculously and were rescued out of trees. The other seven women died that night in those cars. My story is I got out of the car and my friends and we started going up this hill. And I was in a t-shirt, jeans, and a pair of sandals. And the raindrops were this big. What, three storm fronts had converged over Estes Park. That's unheard of. And as I was climbing up the hill, we'd be going up three steps and back going up three. Mud was everywhere. And all my friends, we were going at different paces. And there were all kinds of people from the community that were going up with us. So I'm going up, and I turn around, and there was this, I called her little old lady. She was 71. 75 now. I don't consider myself a little old lady. I went back. She couldn't get up. And I went back, and I put my arms around her, and the two of us just hobbled our way up. And we hit a place where there was a barbed wire fence, and we couldn't get over it. But there was a man that came over, and he started helping all of my friends up over the barbed wire fence. And so we helped her, and then I got up, and we kept climbing to the top of the hill. There was rocks here, and it was a little bit, you know, sheltered from the storm, and they kind of huddled next to those rocks, and I couldn't find my friends, the ones that had been with me. And I looked up, and in a flash of lightning, I saw them up on the top of the hill. So I said, excuse me, I'm going to go find my friends. And I went up to the top of the hill, and they were all in a circle, arms clutched, heads down praying, pouring down rain. And we all looked down at the canyon, and there were propane gas tanks exploding. We could see cars under the river. We could see homes coming down the river. And I remember holding arms together, and one of my friends said, oh, Jesus, we know that you cause all things to work together for good. We don't know how you're going to do it in this case, but we ask you for that. And then we started singing. So here we are on the top of the hill, singing hymn after hymn after hymn. And you know, when we came back that night, it was about 2:30 when they finally came in the morning and said, the flood has finished what it's going to do. You can come down now. So we hobbled our way down with all the other people that were with us from the community. And we talked. We felt bonded. We felt together. And when we came down to our cars and we got finally back to where we were staying, we began to get word that some of our sisters were gone and some were missing. Now, within the next day, they found the ones that were in the cabin. And it took, three of our women were identified that night, and the other four, it took a week to find them. And I look at that time, and a lot of horror in it, but also there was a lot of good. And I can't even begin to tell you all the stories of how God used that year after year after year. But you know, I experienced something that night that I have only occasionally experienced since. And that kind of makes me sad. I experienced a oneness, an equality, a love, and a lack of judgment that touched me to my core. Up on that hill, in the pouring down rain, struggling to climb up that mud-soaked hill, I felt the reality of Paul's statement in Galatians 3:28 when he says there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free. And he hit the three big isms: sexism, racism, and classism. When we were being helped over that barbed wire fence, it didn't matter to us that the people helping us were male or female, black or white, rich or poor, queer or straight, pro-life, pro-choice, liberal, conservative, atheist, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, you name it. We were all people in the same situation, running for our lives. We were, for a moment in time, a community, free from judgment, helping one another for no other reason than we were needy. Were that the church that way today, and our cities, and our communities, and our country. May I suggest that as Father Gregory, he's a wise priest that I heard preach once, said this, that the DNA of sin was when Adam and Eve withdrew from communion with God. Now, whether that was an actual event or a story doesn't matter, because the principle is that when that happened, a profound aloneness fractured the human soul. The principle being that when we're not in relationship with our Creator, and I would go on to say with one another, we don't make sense to ourselves, and we don't make sense to one another. Then they blame their behavior on someone else, and in order to get the focus off themselves and their weakness and their failure, it seems that ever since, the human race has been subject to a one-up, one-down relationship. Her desire will be unto him, yet he's going to rule over her. And folks, that was not the good news. That was the bad news. And from a one-up position, a relationship, we can easily judge those below us. Or we maybe not judge them, but we might feel sorry for them or pity them. Governments, communities, families, individuals are organized in hierarchies. And that's necessary to run a society. But it's what we do with the positions we have that matter. But they're organized in hierarchy structures where power over others is as natural as breathing. Boss, employee, teacher, student, king, commoners owners, renters, and I could go on and on and on. And that's why I believe that one of the most important skills that we can cultivate is that of honest self-reflection regarding our own privilege. Let me define privilege for what I consider privilege. An unearned right or advantage that I have that gives me rights and opportunities that others don't have and can enable me to have power and control over them, whether I see it or not, or whether I want it or not. The psalmist prayed, "Search me, O God, and know me. Try me and know my anxious thoughts and see if there be any hurtful way in me." I think we're supposed to be all the time doing some sort of honest self-evaluation, not in some kind of, too conscientious of a way, but just as a daily practice. Charles Ringma, in his book, Dare to Journey with Henry Nouwen, and I'd love if you would get, it's a daily devotional, he suggests this: because the desire to influence others is always fraught with the danger of illusion and the power to control, self-reflection is required to unmask our own pretensions, to purify our motivations, and to spur us towards true humility. Honest self-reflection involves developing awareness of my privilege and how I've benefited from it at the expense of others who are not so privileged. Let me give some examples. Take, for instance, the wealthier, or even the financially secure. We don't even have to be talking about billionaires versus the poor. The wealthy never think about what their next meal is coming from. They generally are viewed as smarter, more intelligent than the poor. They never worry about their health care, and they aren't thought to be lazy bringing it on themselves, not willing to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Or even let's talk about the privilege adults have over children. Children can't protect themselves. They don't have a voice. They aren't taken seriously, usually until they get older. And then one that is always hard to talk about because people go, oh gosh, you're just prejudiced, but male privilege. Male privilege is simply an unearned advantage and benefit that men experience simply because of their gender. For example, a sense of safety in public spaces. You know, feeling generally safe while walking home alone at night without fear of sexual assault or harassment compared to women who experience this regularly. Or even pay equity. On an average, men earn higher salaries than women for the same work, even when controlling for other factors. Or leadership opportunities. Women couldn't even vote until the early 1900s, so holding any public office was not something they could do. Married women couldn't get a credit card in their name until 1974, when the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was passed. Even today, we hear the phrase, "We aren't ready yet for a female president." Happened in 2000 when Elizabeth Dole, a Republican, ran for office. It happened when Hillary in 16, and then again 24 with Kamala. As a woman, I want to say that's a very demeaning statement. But my challenge, whatever our privilege is, and you guys, those are only three things. We have to do a self-examination to see where we have privilege. Is that we would cultivate, though, honest self-reflection, and that we encourage our friends, our churches, our communities to do that. I would hope you would all go home and talk about it, and because I think it'd be an interesting topic. Because if we don't own our privilege and the power that it can give us, we will at times misuse it. And that's what we don't want to do, is to misuse it. I see privilege as an inherent quality that I possess that gives me opportunities that others don't have. For example, I'll give you the ones I've dealt with in myself. I'm Caucasian. I have privileges granted to me that other people of color don't have, simply because I'm white. I have never had anyone discriminate me because of the color of my skin. I was born into a middle-class family, and although I might have had to work hard, it didn't really occur to me that I couldn't afford an education or figure out how to get the money for an education. The finances. And I've never gone hungry because I don't have money, only because I've been on every diet known to the human race. I'm an adult. I have choices and privileges that children don't have. I can protect myself. I have a voice. I'm taken seriously. I'm educated. I have opportunities that most of the world's population don't have because of my education. I was born in America. I've never experienced persecution due to my political views. That may be changing, but I haven't. And I imagine I could go on and on. Dr. McWhorter, who's a psychologist here at the University of Oregon, wrote a paper that really influenced me a number of years ago, and she says this: we usually are not aware of our privilege. It is invisible to us. I want to say that again, because sometimes when I talk about this, people will say, well, I don't feel privileged. I have a lot of black friends. They say all kinds of things like that. We usually are not aware of privilege. It's invisible to us. And I'm really convinced that if we don't look and figure out where we're privileged, that we will intentionally or unintentionally, use it to hurt others. You know, when I was a therapist and worked with batterers who were in my program, and then earlier with sex offenders who were in my program, every single one of them has said, I didn't intend to hurt them. But you don't just look at the intent, you have to look at the impact of the behavior. They may not have intended it, but the impact hurt. So for me personally, I was a therapist, and now I'm more of a kind of a consultant, spiritual director maybe. And when clients come to me, they put me in a one-up position in relationship to themselves. They're hurting, and they see me as having the knowledge to help them. They give me that power. My job is to always be aware of that position of power and seek to establish an equal relationship so that I do not hurt them by taking their power away. If I pretend that I don't have that power, or if I minimize it, or if I'm blind to it, I run the risk of turning the therapy session into a teacher-student, parent-child, I have the answers, you do not session. They may leave the session educated, but less empowered to change their own lives. I want them to see that they have the internal skills, or that they can develop those skills to manage their own lives. Again, I would challenge all of us to take time to reflect on our own privilege so that we don't misuse it. And in closing, I want to suggest three qualities to cultivate as we practice the art of honest self-reflection. The first one is develop a heart of a servant. Whatever privileges you possess, whatever positions of leadership you hold in your church, in our church, your community, whatever education we have, whatever financial status we have, whatever privilege at all that we possess, we lay it down to serve. You know, when the sons of Zebedee wanted to sit at Jesus' right and left hand, he didn't say to them, that's a really prideful kind of thing to do. He didn't do that at all. He just lifted their eyes to a higher calling. And this is what he said: you know the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them. It is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. And second, develop a heart of humility. In Matthew 11:29, Jesus describes himself as gentle and humble of heart. To be humble is to seek to be like him. Dr. McWhorter suggests this. She says to be humble, I think it's going to be up there, is to see our own flaws and limitations, to approach every situation as a learner and every person we encounter as a potential teacher. I want to say that again because I love that. To approach every situation as a learner and every person we encounter as a potential teacher. We can't carry out social action on the individual level if we already know everything, or if we can't tolerate or accept our own limitations. We'll probably try to cover them up with passivity or overwhelming goodness or with arrogance. And last, just develop a heart of compassion. The book of Colossians tells us to put on a heart of compassion. Kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Compassion is the opposite of condemnation. I really believe that compassion transforms us. While judgment leads to guilt and shame. And what that does is it forces what psychologists call our real self into hiding, and we develop what's called a good false self. And sooner or later, that reveals, time reveals that doing compassion is not the same thing as being compassionate. Under pressure, the false self crumbles and our old behaviors resurface. When I worked with batterers and earlier sex offenders, it really was difficult for me at first not to judge them, especially since I came from a sexually abusive background. But one evening while I was facilitating an advanced group of combined sex offenders and then what we called non-protective adults, they were working on their own family of origin issues. A particular sex offender was recounting the horrible abuse perpetrated on him by his mother. At one point, gripped with agony and unable to talk, he buried his face in his hands. I asked him if I could move closer and put my hand on his shoulder. You always ask permission to touch someone in situations like that. He nodded yes. When I placed my hand on his shoulder, he surprised me by falling into my arms. I held him as gut-wrenching sobs racked his body. Tears flowed freely that night. The man had been a boy, brutalized by an adult. I'd come full circle, the abused comforting the abuser, and it's a gift I will forever cherish. We didn't just learn about compassion that night. We felt compassion that night. We were more than feeling it. We were transformed by compassion that night. The reason we do honest self-reflection is so that we don't hurt anyone else with the privilege that we have. So, thank you.
Can you give her a hand, ladies and gentlemen? That was so good. Thank you, Jackie. Appreciate you. I'm going to give us some announcements in a moment, but could you shut your eyes just if that's comfortable for you? And I want to close us with a prayer. I want to pray it over us, myself included. Please, God, open our eyes. Help us to see. Help us to see our privilege. Help us to see others who don't have it. Help us to see the way our culture is getting it so wrong. Help us to see the ways we can serve, the ways we can heal, and the ways we can love. And please, God, as Jackie was preaching, I thought of the prophet Amos. Let justice roll like a river and righteousness like a never-ending stream. And that will happen, Lord, when we as your people are self-reflective, Lord, and see our privilege. In your name we pray. Everyone said? Amen.